Thank you again to everybody who read to help to start the meeting, and welcome those that have joined us since we first started the meeting, and a particular welcome to any newcomers and visitors to our meeting this evening. And we hope you hear something that's going to encourage you to keep coming back to NA and our group. So we are a speaker meeting this evening, and it falls to me to introduce our speaker. And it gives me genuine delight, actually, to introduce this individual. He's a man who's our paths crossed 20, 25 years ago in the course of service, and we kind of lost touch. We didn't really stay in touch all those years. And in the last couple of years, our paths were crossed again. And it's been a really good perspective for me to actually meet someone and talk to someone who's been on around and doing the same sort of stuff that I've been doing over all these years. Yeah, I'd like to think we've kind of forged a bit of a friendship. So it's really nice to have you here. And without any kind of further ado, I'm going to ask Peter, would you please share with us your experience, strength and hope? Thank you.
My name's Peter. I'm an addict.
Hi, Pete.
Hi, Peter.
This is interesting because I was just reflecting a little bit before, because I'm sat in front of a screen and can't see anybody, and I was just thinking, you know, wow. And I've just heard, I've just been on a regional meeting all day. And it ended with, you know, let's get back to face-to-face meetings when we can, but until the government tell us we can, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I just sat here just now reflecting in front of a screen and just went, do you know what, Peter? Your early recovery was in a red phone box. And I don't know if many of you understand that unless you're kind of in the GB. Because red phone boxes is what we had. Matter of fact, we used to have white ones in Hull because we didn't actually participate in the post office. We was actually owned by the local council. So my recovery was phone boxes and going to the other fellowship, which I wasn't allowed to speak at very often because they used to tell me, you're in the wrong place. And you can sit in the meetings, but you can't share. And that was like that for quite a long time until they trusted what was going to come out of my mouth, I think, really. But in the meantime, there was this lovely bloke called Scouse who took me to my first NA meeting, which was in London. And I lived up in the north of England in a caravan. That meant getting on a bus, then getting on a train, and then traveling all the way down 200 miles down to London, going to an NA meeting for an hour and a half, then turning round, go back on a train, go home, and just remember what was being said. So that was me. That's how I got into the fellowship anyways, all them years ago. So the rest of my recovery stuff was talking to members that I'd met from phone boxes, because when I got clean, I didn't have a mobile phone. As a matter of fact, mobile phones weren't really the thing you have in your back pocket. What was in my back pocket was a little white book, which I still have, that little white book. It hasn't got an outside cover, and I think it's lost loads of pages in it, but I've still got it kicking about somewhere in my memorabilia. But anyways, so that was me thinking about meetings. So how did I get here? I come from a gypsy background. I call myself Roma these days, which is how I see myself. I was brought up in a family that this is not common amongst Roma people, but I was brought up in a family that were kind of like your stereotype that people think gypsies are. And we were very violent. And we used to drink, well, they used to drink a lot. And I was just a little kid. watching all this. And I was the recipient of lots of pain from my mother and her boyfriends, who weren't Roma, most of them. They weren't. One of them apparently was a football player. They used to use me as practice to kick. So I don't know what sort of football he was on with, but it was me who was the ball. But anyway, so that was how I was brought up. We used to always dodge things. Well, I used to dodge things. I remember once I was in a shop with my mother and she reached out to pick something up. And I thought she reached out to hit me, so I ducked. And when I stood back up again, she hit me then for ducking, for embarrassing her. So that's what she said anyways. But I remember me and my younger brother, we wished to watch my mother, and she used to drink this cold tea, as she said it was, prior to her doing things. And so me and my brother got stuck into this cold tea and ended up absolutely out of our heads. He was a lot younger than me. And that really was the first drink I ever actually remember, that this cold tea that put you on your ass. My first arrest, I was 9 years old. I was drunk and disorderly, upside down the bottom of a fishing boat with another little old lad who was a bit older than me. And how I met him was because he we just bumped into each other in a place called Redcar, and he described what it was like at home in his we call it a kenner, but his house. And I described what it was like being in a trailer. And our description were the same parents and the same people, exactly the same. So our idea was, if we couldn't beat them, we'd just join them. So we got absolutely hammered. And so that was my first arrest for drunken disorderly. By the time I'd reached 10 and a half, I was put in a psychiatric unit or criminally insane, and I didn't come out until I was 18. So when I come out, I didn't actually get, for all them years in there, apart from being used as a target for a penis, I never actually got any sort of parental input on how to conduct myself as a human being. I just used to get these so-called nurses telling us what to do and what not to do. But anyway, so when I come out at 18, I had no sexual education. I had no education about anything, really. They couldn't find my mother, so they sent me to Kent, where I live now, in the south of England. And they found a woman who's my grandfather's first wife, and she said she would have me. So she would put up with me. So I rocked up to Kent, because I was in the north of England then, in the unit, and I got sent down to Kent. I got off the train, went out to where I now know as Chilham. And there's this poor old woman, this poor old gypsy woman, who had no idea what she was just about to be landed with, because there was this nutter who didn't know how to live, stood in front of her. And I'd already been addicted to drugs by then, because they used to give me phenobarbital all the time. So I was barbed out all the time just to keep me quiet, because that was the way they kept me quiet. And I had a script when I come out, so I had to go and register with a doctor in Canterbury, and that was me, you know. So I could blame society for setting me up as a junkie, but that's not true. Anyway, so I started, I was doing drugs, prescription ones. And then the next thing was, I met what we call a useful lad. He started selling blueies to me, and I was doing these blueies on top of this phenobarbitans that was like two ends of a magnet fighting each other, because they're just two opposite drugs. Anyways, that was me. I was completely trolled out. I started drinking again by this time. And these days in Canterbury, there were signs up saying whether gypsies could come in or not. More often than not, you weren't allowed in to the pubs. And so I done most of my drinking on the street. Anyway, so the next thing was this young lad, or useful lad, as we would call him at the time, become unuseful because he didn't have any blueies when I turned up to see him. And he just turned around and said to me that he hadn't got any. And I sort of communicated with him in my usual communicating way. And he then told me, what you need to do is go and see this man at this house, and he lives in London. So I jumped on a train and went to London and turned up at this bloke's address. And he said the same thing. He didn't have any. So I communicated with him the same way as I communicate with everybody else. And he said, look, I've got this. And he showed me this bag of powder. And I went, what is that? And that was me and my first rendezvous with heroin. And he showed me how to use it. Anyways, so back to Canterbury with this bag of stuff in my pocket. I had a girlfriend by this time, and because we didn't know anything about sex, her and me, she was very quickly pregnant, and we was having our first son. So she started on this bag of stuff as well with me, and then I knew there was massive trips to London picking up bags of this gear again, and that was me absolutely in love with smack and where I was at with it. When our eldest son was born, the hospital didn't know what to do because he was in a terrible state, and someone just cottoned on to what was going on. So they started to deal with him. And of course, because we knew nothing about sex as such, very quickly we had another child on the way. But this time they knew what to do. They knew what they was preparing themselves for. So in 1973, the courts decided to separate me and their mum from the children, and gave us the opportunity to go to a Salvation Army place to do something about our obsession, or our problem, as they called it. I just told the judge where to go, mind his own business. And he said, you won't see your children again. And I just, so what? So I left. I found myself in Ireland. I left Kent and traveled. I left their mum and just cleared off. By the time I hit the south of Wales, I'd been arrested in seven different cities and blamed Kent for the problem. It was Kent was the problem. And then I went to Ireland and thought I'd escape it all in Ireland, and all I just was met. I just met loads of drugs and loads of booze and loads of problems. And then I come back from Ireland to England, and I got registered as a heroin addict in Cambridge, and they used to give us amps. And all the time, just my life was just chaotic all the time. It's just a chaotic behaviour. I never used to think about my children because I couldn't. I just used to think about me all the time. Me and what was going on around me. I was the center of my whole universe, me. So I was in Cambridge on these amps, and the amp, we used to have to go and sign this thing in the morning at 8 o'clock and be around the chemist for 8:30 to pick up our amps. And if we weren't there at 8:30, we couldn't have them because the chemist wouldn't serve us after 8:30. So anyways, I met a guy, and he said up in Liverpool, there was a doctor giving out 90 mil of methadone, and you didn't have to do anything. You didn't have to perform for it. So I just felt, okay, a gyro, 90 mil of methadone, a couple of flags of cider, buy a bag of gear now and again, be all right. So I went up to Liverpool. And then in Liverpool, a man from Hull said to me, there's a doctor over in Hull, he's got two surgeries, and he gives out 90 mil of methadone each one. And so if you attend both, you'll get two lots of 90 mil. So I thought, oh, two lots of 90 mil a day, and some cider and some bags of gear. Yes, and a gyro. It's cool. Let's go. So I end up in Hull. Now, this is where things started to get really complicated in my head, because the world was starting to get even smaller around. And this human being called Peter was stuck with an Irish accent that I picked up in Ireland, didn't know what was going on around me half the time, and was constantly in trouble with the law and in and out of psychiatric units on a regular basis. And then so the first time I got 12-stepped in 1978, and I was in Cambridge, and it was a bloke in a blue uniform with stripes on him, and he was a sergeant in the police force, and he was coming towards me, and I thought, well, he's going to come and get me and move me on or whatever, or arrest me. And then he started talking this very strange language, this language of identification and empathy, and I'm like, go away, I don't understand you, fuck off and leave me alone, or arrest me. So he arrested me and put me in the night house for 4 months, and come and annoyed me for 4 months about recovery. And that was the first time I heard about recovery. And then back to up in Hull, there used to be a guy in Hull, and he used to come, and he used to have little stickers, and on the stickers he used to write, I called but you was out. And I used to stick them on my chest, on my T-shirt or whatever clothing I had on. He'd always stick these stickers on me. And, you know, I never saw him once. And one day he got me five times. I remember that, five stickers I had on me, because I used to get angry about these stickers because I never saw him. And anyway, so that was the second time I got attacked by a 12-stepper. And then there was a squat in Grimsby, and I used to go over and see the lads in Grimsby. And the squat, the actual property was owned by a guy in recovery of the other fellowship. And he used to come round, he would bring a sin bin for putting all the pins in. And he'd also bring black plastic bags to pick up all the bottles and all the cans. And he used to come into the squat, and he would go, morning, there is a place to go, you know. And we all knew where he meant. By this time, my life was congested into like a small sardine tin. The other sardines that were in there with me were all like me, every one of them, you know. They were just doing the same thing as I was doing. We didn't know what was outside the sardine tin, but we knew about him, because he would come with his morning stuff, and we knew he was in recovery. Anyways, by that time, you was either in the sardine tin with us, or you was in a treatment program, which was more than like a mental institute or Salvation Army type place. Or you was in prison, or you was in a nut house somewhere, or you was dead, or the worst thing you could be is in recovery of the 12-step program. That would be the worst place you could be. So Anyways, one day his wife come down to the squat and she said, he's one of you lot now. And he'd relapsed. And we cheered because it meant it didn't work. So she said, you can come around my house, she says, and help him. He's one of you lot. I want nothing to do with him. And this is the first time that I realized this disease, if you want to call it that, wasn't just a class thing. It just didn't pick on the likes of me. I went to this house and this man's hallway, of which he was laid at the bottom of the stairs, his hallway is bigger than my 3-bedroom house. It was huge. I'd never seen such a huge house. There he was at the bottom of the stairs. Couldn't make the staircase. And so that showed me a different angle to this problem that was mounting up on me. And I realized that that I was doomed. I used to have this calling thing. My sponsor told me about it. He repeats it now and again when he can remember it. I used to sit on the pallets and I'd shout, I'll be dead in the morning. I didn't know why I was saying that. I have no idea, but it was true. I used to say it. Anyway, so our friend, he got back into recovery again, which was bad news because it meant it worked, didn't it? And then he'd done a really stupid thing. He then got a woman who was hanging around with me. And I never quite understood why women was hanging around with me because, I wasn't a safe bet. I was very violent. So more likely I'd be violent to you. And the other thing was that I didn't have like a res pad, I didn't live in fine conditions. And I didn't have really good body odor. And so, I wasn't a good catch, but she liked me. And anyways, he managed to talk her into going to meetings. And so she started going to meetings and started getting a bit, she was starting to evangelize, actually. And I didn't like that. So I ran away and hid out of the way of it all. Anyway, she found me and she was trying to evangelize me again. And I was having none of it. And then come my day, this man who was obsessed about himself, it was my day. I hid myself out in the middle of nowhere, I don't know what I was trying to do, be truthful. But I was in one hell of a state with myself. And these very kind people who turned out to be so, well, become very, very important in my life around early days of my recovery. But they said to me, I can't live like I was and I needed to get out and meet people. And there was an Irish woman in the village and she was coming out and I had no idea what that meant. Right? And I went to this party and I turned up to this party anyways and she focused on me a bit because I was supposed to be Irish and she was Irish. Anyway, they started talking about a woman that was supposed to be being looked at being paroled. And they were saying she shouldn't be paroled. And I just turned around and said, I know her. I remember her coming into a unit that I was in. And if they let me out, they should let her out. And this Irish woman just pounced on me. And just said, you couldn't because you'd have been in Ireland. And this was the first time I started telling the world about my past for the first time. And my head just couldn't cope with it. I just went everywhere, went nuts. So it was the next morning, or the next day, I think it was the next day, I found myself in the corner of a field And my head was hurting so much because the voice inside was screaming at me. And there was another voice screaming at that voice. And it's just this continuous choir going off in my head. And then from nowhere come this telephone number across my head. And I was next to a phone box, a red phone box. And I stood up and I got in the phone box and I phoned this number. I had no idea what it meant. And the voice the other end said, "I wondered when you'd call." And they say, "I've been looking forward to this." What happened? Anyway, so I got picked up by a taxi, taken to her house, and she got me out of the taxi, put me into her house, took all my clothes off me, chucked me in a bath, and then I got out of the bath, and I stood in her kitchen. And I said, "Where's my clothes?" And she said, "I've got rid of them. You'll have to wear some of mine." So I put on a pair of women's leotardy type things, whatever they call them, and like a hoodie little top, and I was sat there in her house. And the next thing she said to me, she was taking me to a meeting, and I went, "I ain't going dressed like this." And she said, "Well, that's all I've got." And they were very colourful, by the way, the little leggings that she had. And they shouted, "Woman!" And anyway, so I noticed that she had a little kilt, so I decided I'd put the kilt on as well and make me like, you know, as though I was some sort of I don't know what I thought of. Anyways, basically, I went to my first meeting dressed as a transvestite in women. I was in women's clothes. That's basically what happened to me. And at that first meeting, them days you could smoke, and there was a guy sat opposite me, and he was shaking like a leaf, and he said, "If you want what I've got, keep coming back." And I thought, "I don't want that, brother." And I didn't know that he was been around for 24 years at the time, but he had Parkinson's, and he turned out to be a very kind man and very helpful. Then sat alongside him was a guy with a scar on his face. I knew him really well because I was the one who put the scar on his face. And he was smiling at me, and I thought, I don't get that. Why is he smiling at me? Him and me should be, you know. And I thought, well, I just thought it'd be something else is going to happen, but it didn't. And that was my first meeting. My friend with a scar on his face become a very dear, devoted friend of mine for 15 years in recovery. I was very sad when he died of cancer. Very, very loving man. And we put a lot of bridges between our relationship that needed to repair a lot. So that started my recovery, and as I told you earlier, this wonderful man called Scouse took me to my first NA meeting, and then I started. So we decided we'd start an NA meeting, and I become a kind of a connoisseur of NA very quickly, because I was still in one of my obsessions. Probably my greatest obsession. It was certainly my greatest compulsion, and that was me. You know, me first, me second. I was a bit of a seagull, really. You know, me, 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 me. Anyway, we started an NA meeting, and then we started another one, and then the recovery program just started to grip hold of me, and I got a sponsor. I still have the same sponsor today, even though he doesn't recognize me half the time. That's not true, actually. I I was encouraged to do the best I can at all times. And when I was starting to panic about myself, which I used to do all the time, just remember there's somebody else out there. That was one of the messages I used to get. Just remember there's somebody else out there. And so we started getting NA growing at the north a little bit. It was quite, it started to stabilize me. I started doing a lot of service. My own personal recovery stuff started to really grip on me. I started to really understand stuff. By this time, my sponsor had taught me to read and write to the best of his ability, which I'm extremely grateful to him for. My first book actually was The Selfish Giant, which I identify with immensely. The Selfish Giant, my God. I really got him. And then my next one was The Basic Text. Well, actually it wasn't, it was The Little White Book, actually. Anyway, so that was me. Service has been a massive part of my life in NA, huge part of my life. I've always been in service. I don't remember a period of time that I wasn't in service of some description or other. I did have a massive break from region, which was nice, actually. So my own personal life, as me and me, I was starting to, you know, read books like Jonathan Livingston's Seagull and seeing that the seagull and me needed to part company a bit, even though the book was nothing about me. But I kept on seeing me in there. And I started realizing that, you know, I needed to stop focusing on me as me and start seeing the bigger picture of life. And then I was exposed to all sorts of ideas of, you know, religions and stuff, and have a look at this and have a look at that. I remember going around my sponsor's house, and every time I used to turn, there'd be another group of people coming out with another big book under their arm that was something to do with another religion. I'm only looking. And I used to just giggle. And then I decided that I would look. And I remember going to a Buddhist group, and then they kicked me out. I was quite shocked. But that was quite nice, actually, because I realized that's not where I wanted to be. I realized that where I wanted to be, I was already there. I was with a bunch of scholars trying to learn how to live a spiritual life. And it was like, that's where you are, Peter. You're just here doing this. Get on with it. Stop moaning. And then I got introduced to, quite early on, I got introduced to St. Francis Prayer, which has become a massive part of my life. I read it every morning without fail. Not always at the same time, but I do read it. I try and act that role that's asked of me in St. Francis' Prayer. Whether I do it well or not, I'm not sure. But what I do know is, when I look into people's eyes, they're not backing away from me like they used to. They smile at me. Oh, some of them are mischievous, you know, look at me and go, oh, yeah, right. But I haven't got that same impact, it would seem, from my eyes to them that I used to have when I was using. The impact I have now is, well, I have friends, not just in the fellowship. I have friends in all sorts of places. And it's lovely, you know. It's not for me to change them either. It's not for me to point out what they're up to. I've got friends of mine who take drugs, and I've got friends of mine who drink, and so on. And But it's not my job to point out what they're doing. My job is to accept them exactly as they are. Because one of the things that I have really, really grasped is to accept Peter as Peter is one of the kindest things that I can do to me. I didn't realize all the time I was using that I couldn't accept me. I just couldn't accept the gypsy boy in me. I couldn't accept this little Roman man, you know. I was always trying to be something else, and I failed miserably at it. And I'm glad of the failure, because the failure gave me a starting point of being me. I've got two children now. Well, they're not children, they're bloody adults. My oldest ones, I have a very, very strange relationship with them. They still struggle with me. I don't blame them. But my younger ones, well, my son works with me. I'm not retired. I'm supposed to be retired, and I'm now back working because my son asked me to help him. So I'm working with my son, and my daughter is on about leaving home with her partner and going off around Europe and extract whatever they're going to do. But she's left university, she's got degrees, and she's been asked to do a master's and all the things that I could never imagine, that would happen around me. And I've been married and divorced in recovery. I found that difficult because I thought we'd be married for the rest of our lives, and we're not. I found my own company. That's an interesting thing, because you marry for life, partner, da 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 da, and then all of a sudden you're not, and you're left yourself again, and your friends, and finding your friendship with the person that you married dissipate, and you have to check yourself to see, where did I go in that? What did I do that I could change? I've looked immensely at that relationship. And now I've been on my own for quite a lot of years now. And well, I say on my own, I don't have a sexual partner. Gotta say, it's been quite a nice time. I'm getting on with me. I find myself chuckling at me a lot, at this quite nutty old boy, one of the most pleasurable things, I get up very early in the morning. I get up at 4 o'clock, and I find myself in the mirror, and I do chuckle at myself in the mirror. I laugh at this character in front of me, who doesn't know an awful lot of things. Thought he did, but doesn't. But he knows one thing for sure. I like the guy in the mirror. I like him. He's all right. He's as silly as they come. He's as lost as they are. But I like his love. I like his attention that he gives me. It's nice. I don't think I'm back with me again as like a seagull. I'm certainly back with who I am. I'm certainly comfortable holding me. I enjoy my own state of play. Me and my son, we had a session where we talked about death, and I don't believe in death in a certain way, and he chuckles at that. And we've had long conversations about it, and he just says, "Dad, you do come across as a dad that likes himself. And I thought that was a really nice thing for him to say to me, even though earlier on he was shouting at me, which was really funny, you know. So I continued to do what I did right at the outset, and that was listen, try and be useful, don't think you know it, be willing to be carried for a while. I that was an interesting lesson to learn. Someone wanting to give you a gift and your arrogance said no. I helped this newcomer years and years ago, and he just kept on wanting to give me things, and I just kept on pushing him back to him. I don't need it. And I remember talking to John the Fish, and John turned around and said, "You arrogant piece of shit." He said, "You give him all the time in the world, and then when he tries to give you the only thing he's got, you reject it. How arrogant can you be?" I was like, wow. Yeah. So I've been given a gift. I've been given this gift of me to work with me and live with me. And I'm grateful for it. And I've just shared a little bit of pocket of where I've been and where I'm at, really. And it's nice just talking to a blank screen, which is quite strange. But yeah, because you can't hear any breathing at the other end of the phone. But that's all right. I spend many, many hours just discussing life with me. So this is just another discussion of life with me. And you who want to choose to listen. So I thank you very much for listening to me. Thank you.